Well, this morning I hope to complete chapter 26 of Matthew. This is the longest chapter in the Gospels. And we were going to make a strong attempt to get all the way to the end. Now, before I do that, you know, I'm always bragging on you folks, everybody I talk to, telling them what an amazing group of people you are, what a great congregation you are, but I do have a bone to pick with you this morning. Last week, during the teaching, you all let me down because I was talking about how Samuel the prophet came and anointed David. I'm thinking Samuel, but out my mouth comes Nathan. And you all just sat there, you just left me hanging. I went right on through. Then afterwards, one person came up and says, "You know, that was Samuel, not Nathan, blessed him." Okay, you can't do that, all right? I need to be corrected. So because my brain and my mouth are not in sync. My brain is usually down the next block and a half, and my mouth's catching up. And those things just happen, and you need to speak up, all right? You got it? Even my wife let me down last week, and what am I going to say? What can I say? All right, so enough of that. Let's get right into Matthew 26. Let's pick it up in verse, I think we'll start in verse 36. I think that's where we left off. Yes, verse 36. Matthew 26, 36. "Then Yeshua came with them to a place called Gethsemanim, or Gethsemane, which means olive crush or olive press, and said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.' And he took them with him, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be grieved and distressed. Then he said to them, 'My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me.' And he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will.' And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, 'So you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.' And I think when Yeshua said that, he was not just speaking to their own weakness. He's speaking about himself. That's why he's praying. His flesh is saying, 'Let this cup pass from me.' But then his spirit, his deeper self, speaks, 'But not my will, yours be done.' He went away again a second time and prayed, saying, 'My Father, this cannot pass away unless I drink it. Your will be done.' Again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more." Same thing. "Not my will, but yours be done." Now what's interesting is in this, we have three main characters in this chapter. We've got Yeshua, of course, who prays the same thing three times. We have Peter, who denies Yeshua three times. And then we have Judas, who betrays Yeshua, and he does it in three stages. And one of the things, if we have time at the very end, we want to compare Peter and Judas, the one who denied him, the one who betrayed him, because it's a parallel story. You have this menorah, you've got Yeshua in the middle, of course. Yeshua's in the middle, but you've got Peter on one side and Judas on the other. And it's very interesting to see what happens here with these two individuals and their relationship to their teacher. Verse 45, "Then he came to the disciples and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand.'" I want you to get a visual image of the setting here for these events. And so this is an aerial shot. Picture yourself going up onto the Temple Mount, getting into a helicopter, just going straight up 200 or 300 feet, And then looking east, down at the foothill of the Mount of Olives, this is what you would see. Down at the bottom, there's a main road which comes right through here. And then you can see all the olive orchards, olive groves. I guess you call them groves, not orchards. Olives everywhere. And right here is a basilica. It's sometimes called the Church of All Nations. Sometimes it's called the Basilica of the Agony. And it is supposedly built right over the site of where Yeshua prayed these things, where the disciples were sleeping. And there's even an ancient olive grove there. Let's take a closer look. This is in that olive grove, and you can see the olive trees here. And these olive trees do date back to the times of Yeshua. Now, what's interesting, when the Romans came through in 70 AD and destroyed the temple, destroyed Jerusalem, they cut down all the trees. And so they would have cut these down right even with the ground. But olive trees are pretty amazing. You cut an olive tree down at the ground, and these new shoots just start coming right up out of the stumps. In fact, you can see in these cracks here, you see there's a new shoot coming out right there, and there's one coming out right there, and they just stick right on out of the bark. It's like it looks like this dead thing, but then out of it you have these new shoots. In fact, there's a prophecy that talks about out of the stump of Jesse, a new shoot comes forth. That's the Messiah. And is it hot in here, or am I just... Yeah. Okay, so maybe we can do something about that. Now, this is called Gethsemane because there at least was, I don't know that there is now, I haven't seen it, but there's an olive press. Now, this is very important. It's very important you understand this. In the production of olive oil, there are two main steps. And here's a photograph from Capernaum where olives will also be prepared. And you see that there are two devices here for getting the oil out of the olives. You see this one on the left. This is called an olive mill or an olive crush. And then over here, you see the remains of an olive press. You use the olive crush first, and then you use the olive press. Now, the reason I'm going into this is because Yeshua, his suffering was in two stages. The first stage was there in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Luke 22 tells us that he was in such distress internally, his body wasn't being tortured, but inside was the torture. And he even sweat drops of blood. The second stage of his agony was when he was actually put on the cross. This time, it's almost like inside, the words he speaks are words of peace. So it was like he had this absolute iron control over his soul, but now his body is the part that's suffering. And that is reflected by these two implements here. You see, on the left, the olive crush, the first thing you do is you take the olives, and they're in like these burlap bags, and you put them in there, and you roll the stone over them once or twice, and the purpose is not to get the oil out, but to crush the pit inside the olive. It's to deal with the inside of the olive, not the outside. Now, when that happens, of course, some oil does come out. But then they take these olives and these bags, or I don't know if they put the bags in there first, or then they put this pulp into the bags. But then they take them over here and then use the olive press now to press all the oil out of these olives. Now, here's a drawing that shows how this is done. Now, this is the olive press. What they would do is right here you see these stacks of olive pulp after they've been through the olive crush. And then there's a beam that comes out across this, and then they'll hang a stone on there, and there are markings where they put these stones. They put the first stone on, and then it squashes it down, and the first oil to come out into the pool here, that's your extra virgin olive oil. That's the best. Then they add another weight. That squishes it more. Then you get your second-rate oil. And then they can add a third, a fourth, and a fifth stone, and each time they add more weight, it's inferior oil. But do you understand what's happening here? In the Garden of Gethsemane, Yeshua was in the oil crush, and it was dealing with the internals. Now, when you do that, some olive oil comes out. You saw blood coming out of his forehead like sweat. But God is dealing inside. My will is this cup passes from me, but not my will, but your will be done. Three times he had to pray that. It's like the stone had to be rolled across those pits three times to completely crush that part of him that just wanted to resist God's will. And then he's taken to Calvary, and there he's nailed to the cross, and this time all the blood comes out. And his hands, his feet, his head, and finally a spear's put in his side. Now comes water and blood. It's like he's completely been crushed now. First the internal, then the external. You see the picture there? It's an amazing picture. It really is an amazing picture. And this is called Gethsemane. I did make room on here, but I'm going to tell you something about what that means. The word Gat means press or crush. And it's spelled just two letters. Shemen means oil, all right? So Shemenim is a plural of oils. Gat Shemenim, the pressing of the oil. Now, this is a gimel and a tav. Now, if you've been with us any time, you know what the letter tav means. What does this letter tav right here mean? Cross. It's the last letter of the alphabet, but it represents the cross. The gimel here, the sages tell us it's a picture of a man who's walking in the Spirit from right to left, but what's he walking to? The cross. So every time you see that word gat, which is an olive crush, an olive press, it pictures a man walking to the cross. Isn't that amazing? Hebrew, I tell you what, there's just nothing like it. Nothing in the world like it. Now here is a picture of a reconstructed olive press, and you can see the stones. I'm sorry, let me use this. You can see the stones hanging at this end. They're squashing down the olive pulp here, and then it goes into this pool, overflows into that. That's because this pool can, the heavy dregs can go to the bottom, and then the rest, the pure oil, goes into here. Now, if you go inside the Basilica of the Agony, or the Church for All Nations, this is what you see. And this rock is just natural rock that would have been exposed in there during the time of Yeshua and these events. And our tradition tells us that this is the rock that he kneeled on when he prayed. Whether it's this very rock or not, who knows? But like our friend says, if it wasn't here, it was near. And so when he's praying, Luke 22, 43 and 44 says, and there appeared to him an angel from heaven strengthening him. Did you ever think about that? An angel appeared to him during this time? The Synoptic Gospels don't bring, or Matthew and Mark don't bring this out. Luke does. An angel came and assisted him. Remember before he's being tested in the wilderness, and angels came to him and ministered to him at the end? This is the really big test. And once again, God sends his angel to strengthen him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. You know, in the word Passover, you don't get this in the English, but in the Greek, I think there's definitely a purposeful play on words. In Luke 22:15, Yeshua said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. Now, in the Greek, the word for Passover is the word Pascha. Pascha, from the word Pesach, Hebrew word Pesach. That's the Passover. But the word suffer in this particular tense is pathein, but the root of that is pascho. Look at the similarities. The only difference between Pascha, Passover, and Pascho, suffer, is just the last letter. It's just the last letter. But I thought that was just a little interesting tidbit to bring out. A couple more passages, or one more passage before we move on. In Hebrews 5, 7 and 8, it refers to Yeshua's suffering. And it says, in the days of his flesh, Yeshua offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. Now, picture that, because that bit of information, loud cries. When he was praying, his disciples are sleeping, and he's crying out. And they're just dead asleep. After all, they'd had a big Passover meal, 4 cups of wine. They'd walked, they were tired. And so they're just crashing. And he's crying out, and they're still sleeping right through the cries. Cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Well, wait a minute. If God heard it, why wasn't he saved from death? I have news for you. God hears all your prayers. Sometimes he says yes to your request. And sometimes he says, no, I've got a better idea. And that's what he said here. No, you have to go through with this, but it'll be worth it. And it said also that Yeshua learned obedience through what he suffered. I think deep down we all know we have this resistance to obedience because we know it involves suffering. It always does. But anything worth doing requires a period of suffering. Everything does. I don't care what it is. Any pursuit that's worthwhile, even some that aren't, but pursuits that are worthwhile always require a period of suffering. Always. No exceptions. And the great picture of the suffering we go through, getting from the beginning to the end, is the wilderness. And that's what we're reading about in our Torah portions last week, this week, and several weeks to come. But there's always a wilderness period, and during that wilderness period, what do? That old part of you wants to go back to Egypt, dies. That new part of you grows up, strengthens, and matures, and you learn to obey. And then you go into the land of fruitfulness. And you can go easy or you can go hard. It took the children of Israel 40 years to make an 11-day journey. And people who have a heart to obey, they can do it in 11 days. Others of us, takes 40 years. But God's determined to bring us across and bring us through. Well, let's pick it up where we left off. Let's start with verse 47. It says, "While he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a large crowd with swords and clubs, who came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he who was betraying him gave them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he's the one.'" Betrayed with a kiss. And you know, we think, how do people do such a thing? How could Judas do such a thing? It's done all the time. I call them Judas ministries, where you make a public display of affection to Jesus. But behind the scenes, you call the number at the bottom of the screen and send your money in. You understand? And all that, they're professionals who make a good living. They're wealthy because people are paying them to make this public display of their affection and love and praise of God and His Son, Jesus Christ. Give me the money. There, it's not wrong to take care of people who teach and minister in the name of the Lord, but there's something wrong about people who go in it because the pay is good and the life is cushy. There's something very, very wrong. In 1 Timothy, Paul, I think, is addressing this. He talks about people whose hearts are wrong. They're very involved in studying the word and teaching and doing all these things. But he says he has an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words, which produce envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth. And look what he says, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. People who think living the godly lifestyle is a way of getting rich, there's something really wrong. That's a depraved mind. And you know, you don't have to get your own televangelism show to do this. There are people I know, sadly enough, they think that by claiming certain verses and embracing certain theology, God's got to make me rich and good-looking and successful, and he's got to gimme, 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 because I'm using these verses almost like an incantation to control him. It's like you got God in a bottle. If I say the verses and believe hard enough, he comes out and grants my wishes. It's the same thing. That's a depraved mind. That is a depraved mind. Don't get me wrong. There's tons of blessing in serving the Lord. But the love of money is the root of all evil. And we need to be very careful here. Very careful. Because, you know, we were talking earlier about that. You got that deeper self and that other part of you, and you argue with each other. It's very easy for you to deceive yourself. I think we do much of Satan's work for him. He's a deceiver, but I don't think he's as good at deceiving us as we are at deceiving ourselves. He says, but I love what Paul finishes with, but godliness with contentment is great gain. So here's a question. Here's a little litmus test for yourself. Which would you rather have? God give you more money and more stuff, or to give you more contentment with what you have? If you're choosing A, better ask God to help you choose B. Okay? Make sense? Let's keep going. Let's see, where did we leave off? Verse 48. Verse 49. Immediately, Judas went to Yeshua and said, "Hail, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Yeshua said to him, "Friend, do what you've come for." Then they came and laid hands on Yeshua and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Yeshua reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest, a servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear. Now, John tells us over in John 18:10 that this disciple is Peter himself. John reveals the identity. This is Peter. Peter is going to be so fearful in just a few hours. Right now, he's bold, and he pulls out a sword and whack. And there's an important principle here. I'm glad this is included. It's a very important principle here, and listen to this. Peter was wanting to defend Yeshua and serve Yeshua and protect Yeshua, but he was doing it completely in the flesh. And whenever we try to serve Yeshua in the flesh, we remove people's ability to hear. We whack people's ears off when we do that. You follow what I'm saying? In Peter's zeal to serve Yeshua, he cut off somebody's ear. We do that every time we try to serve Yeshua in the flesh. And Yeshua rebukes Peter. Then Yeshua said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Now there are 6,000 in a legion. So 12 legions is 72,000 angels. One could have done the job. And at his beck and call, Yeshua had 72,000. But this teaches us a principle. And if we have time at the end of the teaching, we'll talk about this a bit more. And I've included it there. Just an observance of mine. I'm still thinking about it. But it seems like God gives real power to those who refrain from using it. Let me say that again. God grants real power to those who refrain from using it. And the most powerful people I know who have spiritual power and other power, other abilities, are always the people who just kind of hold them back. Now, there are proper times to use them, but always in a refrained way, an understated way. These are the people who live closest to God, who have a heart closest to God. And do you want power? All of us do. All of us want power. The question is why? And all Satan worship, all witchcraft, everything in the occult realm is all about getting power. And unfortunately, a lot of stuff that takes place in faith communities is also about getting power. But I have found the ones that God has granted power to are the ones who refrain from using it. And so why does he give them power if they refrain from using it? So they can use it in very limited ways, and because having it makes them stronger. And the example is Yeshua himself. Could have called down 72,000 angels to rescue him. He didn't. And how about the times you read in the Gospels where they would take Yeshua and they're taking him out to throw him off a hill or do something, and say he just walked through their midst and left. He could have done that. But he refrained from using the power at his beck and call because his concern was doing what God wants him to do, what his Father desires. And so we as believers should be people who have incredible power but walk with great humility and great spiritual modesty in what we do. I think, and I'm always talking about my mom. She was an angel, and you, those of you who know her, you know what I'm talking about. Most powerful people I probably have ever met on this earth. We wouldn't know what to look at her. But when she spoke, people listened, and people remembered what she said. When she prayed, God listened and answered her prayers. But she never, ever, one time, I can never remember mom ever showing off with anything. Never drawing attention to herself, never flaunting her wisdom, her abilities. It was always just being my mom. And that's when power is attractive, when you know people have it and they refrain from using it. If you like the Chronicles of Narnia, picture the children riding on Aslan's back. Here is the creator of Narnia. The lion. But he's playing with his little children, restraining his power. You understand? There's something very, I don't know what the word is. There's something very mystical about this principle. But in my heart, I know it's true. I know it's true. So whenever you start desiring power, ask yourself why. And most of the time, so people notice you. But God gives you power so you can refrain from using it so people notice him. Well, anyways, well, enough of the mystical stuff. Let's move on. Where do we leave off? In verse 54, how then will the scriptures be fulfilled which say that it must happen this way? And there's another reference to the scriptures being fulfilled a few verses down. And what scriptures are those? And first, during the week, I was thinking, well, let's just take the study and start going through all the Hebrew scriptures, or many of the Hebrew scriptures that refer to the Messiah coming and being rejected and all these fulfillments that we see. And I thought, no, there are a lot of books out there that you can read, and many of you have done studies with this, and we couldn't get it all in 1 hour anyway. But here are a few that you might want to jot down. First is Genesis 3:15, which is the earliest prophecy of a Messiah coming and suffering to bring deliverance. This is right in the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve sinned. The whole story of Joseph is a story about a redeemer being rejected by his brothers. Joseph became the deliverer for the entire known world, Egypt and all the countries around. It was one whose brothers rejected. And then when they saw him during 7 years of terrible tribulation, they didn't even recognize him. Isaiah 53. The amazing Isaiah 53. And then if you really want to get down to some of the deeper end of the pool, Daniel 9, especially the end of Daniel 9, verses 21 through 27, where basically, in a nutshell, Daniel, a few hundred years before Yeshua was born, prophesies, and he's in captivity in Babylon at the time, right? He prophesies that a king of Babylon will arise, and he will send the Jews back to go and rebuild the walls and the streets and the temple of Jerusalem. He then says the Messiah will come and be killed. And then he says an army will come and destroy Jerusalem and the temple again. Well, we know that the temple was rebuilt and Jerusalem was restored. And then we know that in 70 AD, it was all destroyed again. According to Daniel 9, somewhere in there, the Messiah came. It's an amazing prophecy. But you might need some help, some good commentaries or a good book as you study that section. But it's a fascinating read. Well, let's continue with verse 57. Those who had seized Yeshua led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. Now, this is at night. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now, the chief priest and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Yeshua so that they might put him to death. Now, that's kind of backward. Usually, you try to get the evidence to decide the truth. They'd already made up their minds or just finding evidence to now to kill Yeshua. This betrays something that I think is in deep in all of us. Most of us, we make up our minds first about a matter, and then we seek evidence to support our decision. And then we call ourselves intellectual, and we like the facts. We just want the facts. Usually we make our decisions, and then we call upon our mental faculties to support the decision we've already made. Isn't that the truth? Don't we tend to do that? Yes, Tim, and if you're here visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. So, Tim, thank you for breaking the ice for us. I think you have to hold that button down until it turns green. There you go.
Question, just real quick. If they were looking for false testimony and didn't find any, even though many false witnesses came forward, were they looking for things that were true? How about if he did wrong? Or they were looking for false things about him? Because that seems to be a contradiction. And then one thing I would say is that if they didn't find anything, this seems to be a very solid case for him being very good Jew.
Oh, yes. I want to, excellent points, both. Let's address the second one first. You know, I'll tell people, you know, Yeshua, he wore tefillin, the phylacteries. Oh, how do you know that? Doesn't say. Well, it says right here. They tried to find some fault with him, couldn't find any. If he didn't wear phylacteries, if he didn't keep the Sabbath, if he didn't wear a tzitzit, if he didn't do all these things, they'd have had lots of things to point out and say, see, he's a sinner, he's not keeping the commandments. They couldn't find anything against him. But going back to your first question, I don't know whether they're actually looking things are purposely false simply so they could have a technicality, have something they could put down on paper as a reason for executing him, or if they're looking for something true that they thought they could hang him with. My opinion, I don't think they really cared. They just wanted it dead by tomorrow, and whatever they could do. They would go with anything they got. We're going to look at how illegal this court was in just a moment. But that's a great question. They just wanted him dead. Verse 60. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days, which is not what Yeshua said. The high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? By the way, little footnote. When you go to Revelation, we see the false Messiah arise. Then we find two true witnesses who bring him down. Okay? But Yeshua kept silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God. Now, once he said that, Yeshua had to answer, or else he would be violating the Torah. I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Yeshua said to him, you have said it. This is a Hebrew idiom for meaning, yes, you're correct. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, which is a quote from Psalm 110, verse 1, and coming on the clouds of heaven, which is a quote from Daniel 7. Verse 13. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They answered, he deserves death. Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fist. And others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, you Messiah. Who is the one who hit you? Now, Edersheim, the Messianic Jewish believer and scholar, Alfred Edersheim is his name. He wrote a couple of large books, very scholarly books, and the one he's most famous for is The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. He goes through and lists all the things from the Torah and the Talmud which made this trial illegal. Daniel Lancaster did me the favor of, in his commentary, just listing these, so I'm stealing this right from Daniel. I'll apologize next Saturday when he comes. But here are the things that are illegal about this trial. And there are a few others I didn't put in here, but these are the main ones. The Sanhedrin could not try a capital case outside their regular meeting place on the Temple Mount. Where did this trial take place? In Caiaphas' palace, which is on the west side, quite a ways away from the Temple Mount. Capital cases had to be tried by daylight. When did they try this one? Nighttime. No trials could be held on Sabbaths or holy days or on the eve of a festival or Sabbath. This is the eve of Passover. In fact, the Pharisees believe this was Passover day. The Sadducees, of whom Caiaphas was a member, believe that the next day was Passover. But it still made this an eve of a Passover either way. Passover the eve of it, and it was illegal to have a trial. They're having a trial. In a capital case, the court did not declare a guilty verdict the same day as the trial. They had to sleep on it. The next day, they give their verdict. In a capital case, when the testimony of witnesses proves false, the judges nullify it and punish the witnesses. And it says many false prophecy, false witnesses came forward, but none of them panned out to be true. Yeah, if you look at Deuteronomy 19, verses 18 to 20, which says this, the judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. Isn't that interesting? But they had all these false witnesses, proven to be false, they did nothing to them. In capital cases, the court appointed a defense attorney to defend the accused. Who was Yeshua's defense attorney? Nobody. The accused is not allowed to incriminate himself. If the high priest says, I adjure you by the name of God, you tell us right now if you're the Messiah. And in the capital case, senior judges vote last to avoid influencing the court. And yet, the high priest jumps up, well, he's blasphemed. What more do we need to hear? So, and there are several other things, but these are the main ones. Everything was upside down and backwards. And you think, well, how'd they get away with this? Well, here's one of the things. This was not a full sitting of the Sanhedrin. There are probably no Pharisees there. But since the high priest that year was a Sadducee, the Sadducees reject everything about the Pharisees. They reject everything except for the Torah. They reject the prophets and the writings and everything else. They just embrace the Torah. And they do that in kind of a twisted and limited way. They kind of took matters into their own hands and says, we don't need to follow these things the Pharisees do. We're going to do this our way. And that's why this trial was so horrible and so awful. And while I was thinking about Sadducees, this week I was thinking it's kind of weird. You have the Sadducees that who embraced the Torah, rejected everything else. And today we have people who embrace everything else and reject the Torah. So I call these two groups the Sadducees and the Sujisads. We need to embrace God's word, all of it. It's all his word. It's all eternal. A few weeks ago, Brad Walters walked up to me and handed me this book and says, can you read this? This is a book. It's all in Hebrew. It's over 400 pages long. Very fine print. And it's like, You know, and this is very dense stuff. I could make out about every third or fourth word. And it's like, basically, no, I could make out most of the cover, or bits of the cover. And I said, where'd you get this book? What's this about? And he shared a website with me. And I've put a link to it on our website, the Beth Tikkun website. But it's called facingeachother.com. And the website is put together by a gentleman, an Orthodox Jewish gentleman, whose name is Ariel Cohen Aloro. Aloro. A-L-L-O-R-O. And this gentleman, this scholar, is a believer, an Orthodox Jewish believer in Yeshua as the Messiah. And his move today among the Orthodox Jews and around the world is that we need to go back and retry Yeshua of Nazareth, because the first trial was bogus. And he's seriously wanting to do this, to have a retrial. We'll take the evidence that's given to us in the Gospels. This time let's do it the right way and see if the verdict comes out differently. He says there's another thing we need to do. We need to have a pidyon habin. A pidyon habin means a redemption of the firstborn, because in the Torah it talks about when a couple get married and they have their first child, and they have a son, the firstborn son, that they have to redeem him. What they do today is they'll take some pieces of silver, they'll go down to the coin shop and get a couple silver dollars, and they give them to whoever a Kohen is in the in their congregation. And there's a blessing that's done, and it's the redemption of the firstborn. And Aloro is saying, Yeshua was sold for 30 pieces of silver. We need to purchase him back. We need to have redemption and redeem him back and have a new trial. Yes, now, there's a hand up over here, so let's get a microphone over here. And there we go, it's coming around. Would you raise your hand again so Mike can see where to bring it? There we go. And while that's coming around, go to the website, and Aloro does speak English. It's broken English, a strong accent. But if you go to this website and watch the video, it'll just pop right up, and he'll start sharing with you what his burden is to restore Yeshua as the actual Messiah of Israel. It's an amazing short video to watch. Yes, go right ahead.
In that first trial in 65, when the high priest tore his robes, did that disqualify him? Because when we look at Leviticus 21:10, it says that the high priest among the brothers who has been consecrated to wear the garments shall not uncover his head or tear his clothes.
Yeah, probably, but then again, maybe not, because the garments that are being referred to there are the priestly garments, and he would not have been wearing the priestly garments when he was at home in his own palace. But then again, there might be, I'm not sure, but there might be a tradition where high priests never go into the kind of grief where they tear their clothes. But that's an excellent question. Maybe somebody else there has an answer for that. I just see other questions. All right. I think Adam had his hand up first, and then Valerie.
I guess maybe not necessarily a question, but I just wanted to share. I was reading Leviticus this week, and in Leviticus 5, right in the midst of sin offerings for unintentional sin, there's just one little verse that's kind of snuck in between a sacrifice and an explanation about unclean. Mm-hmm. And it says, if a person sins because he does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he has seen or learned about, he will be held responsible. It just really struck me because, number one, it's referencing so much of this trial, but also I think everything that's unfolded after that, and how I think reluctant everyone is sometimes to just step forward and speak simple truth that they've seen. And
I'm glad you did. Yeah, you know, as you're talking, I was thinking this whole trial, to me, proves Yeshua was innocent. But the whole trial proves that everyone else involved in it was actually guilty. It's pretty amazing. And Valerie, I think you had your hand up, didn't you?
Is there any other record of the Sanhedrin doing this to someone else? Was this a practice of theirs, or was this just a one time that they hated him so much that they did anything? Or is this just something that they usually did when they wanted to?
Well, the question is, was this the actual Sanhedrin, or Caiaphas and a bunch of the leaders? You have to have 23 people to hear a capital case. And I wonder if there were 23 members of the Sanhedrin even present, or was it just a token group? Caiaphas, remember, was in the back pocket of the Romans. He was an illegitimate high priest, and he was just a nasty character. So I think the main thing was he wanted Yeshua dead because he thought it's going to keep peace, keep the Romans from dealing with this themselves. So we'll deal with it ourselves. And however he got to a guilty verdict and to Yeshua being crucified, he was going to do it. So it was just dirty pool all the way around. Yes, Tony. And then I know there are a couple hands up over here as well. And here comes the microphone. We need to get one of those things like after the Super Bowl where the cameras zoom around on wires.
You know, as we look at this, what I see is the Sanhedrin, they would have to relinquish power.
Yeah.
And it would give the power to the people.
Yeah.
If Yeshua is preaching the truth,
yes,
then they have to give power to the people.
Yeah.
They were unwilling. And this is what we have brought us up to.
Yeah. So true. Yeah, they feared the Romans, but they didn't fear God. That was their problem. Yeah. And you know, go back, what did Yeshua actually say that they're trying to pin on him? He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the writer says he's referring to the temple of his body, and sure enough, 3 days later, his body comes out of the tomb. But they're trying to pin it on him, like he's saying, destroy the temple here, God's house, and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And that's not what he was saying. But what's so interesting is that you take the physical temple of stone and you take Yeshua's body, which was a temple of God, no question about it. And when they chose to destroy the physical temple of Yeshua's body, they passed the verdict on the physical temple of God's house. If they had spared Yeshua, God would have spared their temple. But by destroying the body of Yeshua, they were destroying the temple of God. And 40 years later, the Romans come in and actually destroy their temple. The very thing they feared happening happened because of what they did. Isn't that something? So, there were some hands over here earlier. Do you remember what you're going to... Yes, let's take this gentleman right here.
Second matching testimony.
Right.
And the only matching testimonies they could give were ones where they twisted his words.
Yes, that's true. They had to find two false witnesses who could agree to say the same thing. Yeah. It was so backwards and so bizarre. Yeah, absolutely. And Jim, yes, thank you. And Jim. Hold the microphone. There we go.
Is there a way to determine if it was God's providence?
So Jim, the question Jim is asking is, was it God's providence or Judas's betrayal? Answer is yes. In Hebraic thought, there's rarely an either or. And so did Judas operate with free will? Absolutely. And was God in control? Absolutely. You understand how free will and God's sovereignty work, you embrace both. Not one or the other. That's an error. You embrace both. God's in control, but we still have free choice. And somehow, in the realm of quantum physics, it all makes sense. But so. And one more comment. Yes, right here.
I believe he gave him the authority at Passover when he said, go and do it.
Yes. Yes, he did. That's right. And Yeshua knew full well what it was going to cost him personally. Good point. Thank you. Okay, well, let's... I want to show you a close-up of the cover of this book. Now, the cover of the book has kind of a weird title. It's Yamak Shemo, which means may his name be blotted out. Now, that doesn't sound like a very good title for a book about Yeshua being the Messiah. But in the Orthodox realm, the Jewish realm, whenever they're in a conversation and Yeshua's name must be mentioned, they always follow it with Yamak Shemo, may his name be blotted out. So why does Aloro put that in large letters at the title? Well, you see the green and blue letters here and then the brown and red letter? You rearrange those words and they spell Mashiach. So the book is saying every time you say Yamak Shemo, you're actually pronouncing his name, the Messiah. So, and this picture is quite fascinating too, but... yeah, well, anyways, you can talk about that in Oneg, and I'll give the book back to Brad, and we'll let Brad explain the picture to you then. It's a very interesting picture. And, okay, let's move on. The reason the picture is so odd, it shows a picture of a donkey riding a horse. I can't avoid talking about it. I just have to talk about it. It's just coming out. I can't get it back in. All right. There's the picture, which is very weird. You see, in the banner here, it's got a quote from Esther 6:9. And in Esther 6:9 it says, "And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Now, if you know the story of Esther, who's being quoted there? Who spoke those words?
Haman.
Because he thought the king was going to do this for him. And the king says, "Great advice, Haman. Go get Mordecai, your mortal enemy, who you'd like to see dead, and do that for him." Now, if you look at the picture, Haman here is not actually Haman. It's a Jew with peos. And he's leading the horse, but on the horse is a donkey. What does that mean? Well, that word, that phrase, and let him ride or let him be set, is the word, get my Hebrew out here, where it's big enough to see, vehir kivehu, vehir kavuhu is what it is. Vehir kavuhu, and Aloro realizes that that word has a numerical value of 254, which is the same as the word chamor, which is a donkey, which is equals 254. And he's saying, this one that they're sitting on the horse, he says you can translate this as, put the chamor al hasus, put the donkey on the horse. Now, why is he doing this? What's this all about? The first time Messiah rides into Jerusalem, what did he ride on? When he returns at the second coming, what is he riding on? A horse. And now we think when you call somebody a donkey, that's a put down. But a donkey in the Bible is an animal that's highly admired. In fact, it's the only animal that has to be redeemed with silver, like a human being. Remember, if you don't redeem a firstborn donkey, you have to axe its neck. You have to kill it. The only animal has to be redeemed with silver. Donkeys in the Bible are quite different. And so what he's saying here is in the familiar story of Haman having to lead Mordecai around on a horse, he says, really, that's a picture of our rejection of our own Messiah who will come riding on a horse, and we need to wake up. Okay? So that's some of the symbolism behind this fascinating picture on the cover of his book. I know when I first saw that, that kind of threw me, but... After thinking about it a while, it started to make more sense. Well, let's go ahead and finish up our chapter, and we'll try to finish this in 5 minutes. Verse 69, "Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him and said, 'You too are with Yeshua the Galilean.' But he denied it before them all, saying, 'I do not know what you're talking about.' When he had gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, This man was with Yeshua of Nazareth. And again, he denied it with an oath. In other words, I swear to God, I do not know the man. A little later, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, surely you too are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away. He's from the Galilee, and they pronounce the Vav and a little bit differently. I could tell from his accent. Then he began to curse and swear, I do not know the man. And immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word which Yeshua had said, before a rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. So let's compare Judas and Peter. Judas betrayed Yeshua. Peter denied him, denied knowing him. Judas loved money. He loved to control. Peter wasn't love of money, love of control. It was a fear of death. And why did he boast? Oh, I'll die with you. Why did he do that? He feared rejection. He was the oldest of the disciples. He's considered the leader because he was the oldest. And so he always felt like, I need to prove myself as the leader. So there was some ego going on. Now, it tells us in Luke 22:3 that Satan entered Judas. But in Luke 22, verse 31, Yeshua tells Peter this, in verses 31 and 32. Yeshua says to him, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat, but I've prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. So Satan sifts Peter. Now, when they would sift wheat, what they would do is they put it through a sifter to get any of the little rocks out. Well, there was a rock in Peter's soul. Boy, this really exposed it. The rock had a rock, you see. And then how did Peter eventually die years later? Crucifixion. And he went courageously to his death. And he was crucified right there where St. Peter's Basilica now stands in Rome. At least that's what tradition teaches. Now, Judas made an outward show of affection. But what did Peter do? He showed disdain. I don't even know the man. I swear to God, I'm not him. I'm not Peter. I'm not one of his followers. Judas is a man of action. Peter is a man of talk. But we see Judas replaced in Acts chapter 1. He's replaced. But we see Peter restored. And I love these words in Mark 16:7. Where the angel appears to the disciples after the resurrection, he says, go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before him, before you to Galilee. Why does he single out Peter? Because Peter, I'm sure, was thinking of Yeshua's words, but whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven. And those had to be ringing in Peter's ears. I've denied him, not once, three times, after I swore I'd go to death for him. So he'll deny me before his Father. I'm a washout. I'm a loser. I'm not one of his disciples. Can you imagine the heartbreak? And yet God restored him. God's a God of second chances, third chances. He's gracious, and more than we can imagine. So, Roger, your hand is up first. So, Mike, pass the microphone.
I was wondering if that's why when Jesus appeared on the shore, they were on the boat fishing, he came out and he said to Peter, he asked him three times.
Three times, do you love
him? Three times, yes. Do you love me?
Yeah.
Feed my sheep.
Yeah.
Do you love me?
Yeah. Exactly. So you see Yeshua's three prayers. You see Peter's three denials, and then later three times Yeshua asked him, do you love me? Judas did something three times. His betrayal was in three stages. The first is early in chapter 26. Where, thank you for your comment, but we'll still get in out of here on time. All right. At least, I mean, on my time. I won't go over my 5 minutes. But the first thing, early in the chapter, Judas goes to the priest and does the deal, gets the 30 pieces of silver. And then in what we just read, he then leads the mob to Yeshua in the Garden of Gethsemane. So that's the second act. But the third act of betrayal comes early in the next chapter, where he goes back and he says, no, I want to undo the deal. They said, well, it's too late now. And then Judas goes and hangs himself. That was a third act of betrayal. And it's pretty fascinating to put those together. I put these up here to draw your attention to this, but I hope you'll be thinking about this during the week. Why was Peter's denial of Yeshua something that was forgivable, something that was undone? He was completely restored. But Judas, he was replaced. Think about these and ask yourself, when have I been guilty of betraying Yeshua, showing outward affection while just trying to make money off of him? Whereas Peter showed outward disdain to save his own skin. I think both of us have a bit of Judas and a bit of Peter in both of us. But I know one thing, it's a similar thing. You should add one more line to both of these. They both experience incredible grief and regret. Both of them. The pain that they both felt, so much where Judas killed himself, but the grief and regret they felt is something I think is almost unimaginable for us. And Adam, it'll be your fault that we're running over. We'll give you the last word.
The other quote from Mark 16, to me I see this reference to the disciples, you know, and Peter. And I guess there's no way of knowing, like, Peter's spoken to the disciples, but like, Peter, you need to go away. Or did he not show up, or was he there but just removed? But to me, it's that, you know, there's so often we can, I want to go to church, I want to sit at study, I don't want to come before God in prayer, because we know we mess up, but we see this here thin, though, you know, come back, you know, and to me, it's the fact that he sought him out because Peter, like, to some degree, separated himself from the other disciples and said, go tell them all. So I don't know, to me, this is very encouraging for those days when I
learn
myself to know, you know, he says, Adam, you went by the cocoon, you become before me in prayer.
Yeah. Good point. Well, you know, it's I always say the problem is the solution. Peter's denial of Yeshua was a necessary thing for Peter's growth, because this thing had to be sifted out of him, and this is the perfect way to do it. And after he went through this experience, it's almost like Yeshua says, now I can really use you. Now you're ready to really be my disciple and go out into the world. But we had to get this thing of ego out of you first. Because I think this knocked every bit of ego out of Peter. There was just none left after what he did. He made a fool of himself, too, in front of all the disciples and what he did. So, all right. Well, let's close in prayer. And while we're doing so, Tim, I'll invite you up to lead us in the Bracha. Our Father and King, thank you so much for these wonderful words. And, Lord, I pray that you would grant Ariel Cohen Aloro grace in the eyes of his brothers, so that a fair trial could be held and Yeshua can be acquitted of all charges and he might be placed where he deserves, and that is at the head of Israel's people on the throne of David as the Messiah, the Son of God. Lord, you're doing an amazing work among our brother and sister Israelites, and I pray, Father, you continue that and that they would soon say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In the meantime, Lord, use these words and this time together to make us more the people you want us to be, more faithful. Help us to be careful to never deny you, to never betray you, but to be obedient servants. And as you grant us power, may we learn to refrain from using it until it's exactly the right point and done in a measured way with great humility. And we'll give you praise for it in Yeshua's name. Amen. Well, let's stand together. And Tim?
Join me in singing the Bracha.
Baruch atah Adonai, Elohim melech haolam, borei bari hagafen. Amen.
Blessed are you, Adonai our God, King of the universe, who creates the fruit of the vine.
Amen.
And blessing over the bread.
Baruch atah Adonai Elohim melech haolam, hamotzei lechem min haaretz. Amen.
Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth. You are dismissed.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So the group that we're meeting with on Wednesday nights, they're planning on coming.
Do you want to take a look at that?
I want to.
They're going to cover the next tour service.
They are?
Oh, yes.
Cool. Awesome.
A couple of them have come before. I think Tom's kids have come, and they liked it. Another gentleman came a couple weeks ago, and they were here for the liturgy. And
yeah.
He was like, that's kind of dry. Anyway, I'm wondering if there's something I can, or anything you'd recommend that I share with them to prepare them for what they're going to experience. Because they're all kind of evangelical.
Why don't you share Acts chapter 2?
They'll be here for this too.
Oh, great. I would share this. Verse 41, 42. So then those who received the word were baptized, and that day were added about 3,000 souls. They were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread and to the prayers.
Okay.
So as disciples, we want to continue with the prayers as well.
Right. Okay.
These are the same prayers.
Yeah.
So this is a very second chapter of Acts thing we're doing.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, we always want to talk about baptism of spirit and Pentecost. That's wonderful, but continuing the prayers, the liturgy, goes right along with it. That's what they did.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That'll work.
All right. Thank good. You. You're welcome.
Have you... This is very basic.
Yes. I have both volumes.
Okay, wonderful.
I got them in hardback when they first came out.
If you don't have it, you need it because this is the thing you have to teach all the time.
That's one of the things that took my turn.
I figured you had it all.
Yeah, and you have both volumes?
Okay, good
stuff.
Fun.
Yeah,
oh, yes. Fun. Craziness. So, is this his way of trying to reach his people with this whole
Brad's in contact with them, and we want to support him in translating this into English.
Well, that's what I'm up here asking. English?
No, not yet.
It needs to be.
But, it's very dense. Wouldn't that be something? Yeah. Did you want to see it?
Well, I was wondering if you have a copy of that trials and violations.
You can print it out on the website.
Oh, okay.
Or you just want to copy them down?
I didn't know if you had an extra copy.
I don't. In fact, it's right here. What I can do... Oh, I know what. I do have something. Just a second. I'll give this to you. This is the full list. Well, you've got Daniel Lancaster's Chronicles of Messiah set.
Yeah. Is it in that?
Yeah. That's where I copied it out of. There it is.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. What page? All
right. Page number didn't show up, but it's where it goes over the trial. But there it is, right there, this whole section.
The Chronicles of the Messiah. Okay, I'll look it up there.
So. Volume 5.
Okay, I'll look it up there.
Volume 5, yeah.
That was good. I enjoyed it. Gethsemane means olive press, right?
Shemen is oil, oil press. But the gat could be a press or a crush. It just means the squeezing out of the juice.
Okay, it doesn't mean olive, though.
No. Olive is zate. Zate does appear there.
Correct.
So it's oil press. Okay. Oil press, yeah.
Oil press. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I was sure thing. About that too, so I'm glad you asked.
Because
I covered one of my cuts.
Yeah. Shemen is oil. Zate is olive, and zate's not mentioned. Yeah.
I was doing a devotional with kids in school, and I came up with the word light. Or, I believe it was light, and olive, Vav,
yes.
I was surprised to see that, of course, Vav is man, walking away from God as well, and Resh, I was surprised to see that wickedness.
Well, the word wicked starts with Resh, but the word Resh means head.
Yeah,
he's following his own common sense.
Yeah, walking away from the puff, which is sanctification.
Yes. Right.
So
thank you, David.
John 3:19, and then love darkness rather than light.
Yep.
Well,
so true.
Okay, thanks, brother.
All right, you're welcome.